The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about something of utmost importance. It's the subject of andropause, and we're going to talk to a real expert. She is an endocrinologist. Not only is she an endocrinologist, she is what is termed an andrologist, which is a subspecialty within endocrinology, which focuses on male hormonal problems. She's a graduate of Yale School of Medicine, where she has taught for 25 years as an associate clinical professor. And she's one of the nation's top endocrinologists. She's served on numerous advisory councils and committees with the National Institutes of Health, the Age Management Medicine Group, and the Institute of Medicine, or the IOM. And she has a private practice in Manhattan, where she deals with the optimization issues of individuals from all over the world. She is Dr. Florence Comite. It's spelled C-O-M-I-T-E. And she's written a book with the provocative title of Keep It Up. And by that, she means your health, your body, your energy, and your strength. And perhaps there is a metaphorical reference to some other part of your anatomy. So with excuse me. So without further ado, here's our today's guest, Dr. Florence Comite. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you for that amazing introduction. I have to say that you're quite impressive yourself, and I know you've been a host of Intelligent Medicine, and you have the longest-running physician-hosted medical talk show on air, I believe.
Indeed. Well, thank you. You've been obviously doing your homework. And it occurs to me that we actually have known each other in the past, that, and you reminded me as we prepared for this interview, that we met way back in 1996, and the occasion was you were working with the late, great former Attorney General, C. Edward Coop, is that correct?
Exactly.
See, yeah. Everett Coop, that is.
Yeah, we used to call him Chick Coop. And that
right.
arose out of what he told me once was his skinny legs. So he used to be called Chicken Legs. So his nickname for people who knew him was Chick.
Well, that's some real inside baseball on the former Surgeon General.
He was a real sweetheart. I miss him.
I have to say that,
you know, last year.
Yeah, I have to say that he was the last Attorney General who really seemed to command the respect and inspire Americans, because afterwards we've had a succession of rather lackluster, not attorney generals, surgeon generals. But he really was a very, very potent voice within the field of medicine, exhorting Americans to health way back in, I guess it was the 1990s that he prevailed, right?
Yep, exactly. And he came up against a lot of battles and a lot of fights. It was because of him that we have the first warning on cigarette packages, and he just really was an amazing, bigger than life, truly, gentleman, and we had a lot of fun together. Very futuristic, very forward thinking.
Okay, so the whole orientation of your practice is towards optimization, and one of your main chapters in the book is about testosterone, but you're all about generally optimizing the health of both men and women with a focus on male problems, not just sexual problems, but overall health problems. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, I think it all began in terms of how you look at an individual back a few years ago when I realized that each of us is unique. And with my training in endocrinology and hormones, both for men and women, I think as we age into our 30s, our body begins to decline. And it was with that interest in mind that I looked at the role of hormones and how that fed the decline that we all naturally begin to see pretty much around 40, when you see a lot of men wearing belts below their bellies. If they're not, and many of them blame it on not having enough time, they're busy raising a family, working hard, they can't get into the gym. But even those athletes, those folks we all see and admire who run marathons and compete, And I have about a third of my practice is in that category, recognize that they don't have the same health, the same sense of well-being, the same recovery. They just can't do what they used to do a decade before.
And so this may or may not have to do with testosterone because it's kind of complex. So give us a profile of a typical patient that you might see, and then, you know, what are some of the tests that you may run on that patient?
Yeah, so in general, all men and all women start declining in the 30s. And for men, testosterone plays a huge role in maintaining muscle mass and a sense of well-being, even the way their brain feels. And so it would be important to establish a baseline and get tests that look specifically at testosterone, but not just total testosterone, because that number sometimes is meaningless. A lot of doctors look at that number and say, as long as it's above 300 or 350, mm-hmm. you're certainly okay. But a lot of testosterone...
That's a little bit like saying, hey, you know, as long as your IQ is above 90, you're normal. So if your IQ is like 95, hey, you're fine, no problem. But that might, you know, enable you to, you know, get a job, maybe stacking... the shelves of a grocery store. Actually, you know, I have to say that was one of my jobs when I was first breaking into the workforce. But I think you know what I said. In other words,
jobs that are not
physically or intellectually demanding.
That's a wonderful analogy. I've never even thought of it that way, but you're absolutely right. And what I generally point out to new male patients and new men that I'm seeing is the ranges that we're actually given are appropriate to being old. And what happens when you're older, testosterone is fundamentally important, not just for, you know, sexual function, which is a huge topic, of course, in and of itself, but also for the heart to muscle, the brain to think, the bones. And so as that declines, which begins to happen in the 30s, you'll see an effect, and the number you really want to look at is your free testosterone, because most of testosterone is bound up in the body. And yet the ranges that we're given and the levels that that we seem to be comfortable with are really more appropriate to a boy entering puberty or an older man, as opposed to maintaining the health you had in your late 20s when testosterone levels would be somewhat higher.
Now, is it the goal of medicine to restore testosterone levels or free testosterone levels of every man to high normal for 20 to 30? Isn't it somewhat normal to see, you know, a little bit of a decline? So every 85 or 90-year-old doesn't need to have the testosterone of a 20-something.
Another great question. So do you really need to have a testosterone that's a high end of what you think of as a normal range? Well, first I begin with the fact that there's no such thing as normal. And the why I say that is that each one of us is unique. I myself am an identical twin. And my identical twin and I don't even have the exact same genes. You know, when you look at genetic makeup, you're a little different because genes can actually change. The real way you want to look at it is you want to take each individual for themselves and try to predict where they might have been in their 20s. And even better than that, in today's world, I would encourage everybody to get a kind of baseline evaluation of some of these tests, including the hormone test, in their 20s. So there's really a record for where you are when life is good and you're burning the candle at both ends and you don't feel the pain. Because subsequently you will, and you'll begin to decline. And you're really so unique that the curve, what we think of as a bell-shaped curve, might mean that for an average male, you want a free testosterone of 150. But what if you're ahead of that curve and you're someone who actually has a lot more testosterone? You might have a free testosterone of 300. But if you're at the other end of the curve, maybe your average testosterone free, I'm talking about, is 150. So there's a whole range of numbers that really specifically are unique to the individual. And looking at that in the context of the person's general health is really what's going to be important, weighing in on the role testosterone has to play overall in your body.
And what are some of the things that rob us of testosterone? You know, certainly as you age, testosterone tends to go down. But, you know, when I look at testosterone in my patients, I see some men well into their 70s and beyond who seem to have pretty decent testosterone. Other men experience a decline much faster. Is it all genetically programmed? Or are there certain lifestyle factors, health issues that tend to deplete testosterone?
Another great question. So, again, because of the uniqueness of each human being, it's been a fascinating journey for me because I look at both men and women. And what happens in men, in contrast to women, the change in our system in women is very tight. And mostly around 50, 51, women begin to notice that their cycles are changing and their whole hormonal milieu is beginning to drift in a new direction. And that actually starts at 40, but it's fully kind of developed, and for most women by their early 50s, they're no longer cycling. In men, there's a huge range. So while it can start as early as late 30s or early 40s, and that could be driven by lifestyle, which I'll get into, I've seen men even into their 70s, late 70s, have the ability to manufacture and make testosterone. Usually not as well as they did when they were 25 or 30. But overall, the range is quite dramatic.
And so these lifestyle factors include what? What are some real testosterone-draining lifestyle factors?
Okay, so great question again. Testosterone-draining lifestyle factors are the usual. You know, you're working too hard, you're stressed, you're not sleeping enough, and all of those factors, you're sick, you don't feel well. All of those factors are going to stop your body from producing adequate amounts of testosterone, because the body actually feels, the way we're programmed, that making testosterone is important for reproducing the species. And once our body goes into a decline, reproducing and reproduction itself is considered not so important. It's one of the first hormones that fall down, that fall out, when life is tough and you're sick and not feeling well. So if you can take even a 25 or 30-year-old who's under the gun, stressed at all levels, working hard, not able to get his act together, maybe he's the father of one or two children, and when you measure their testosterone, and there's data for this, it's quite low. But if you take that same 25 or 30-year-old someone, and you look at them and when they're feeling well and they're sleeping and they're rested and life has gotten under control, the kids are sleeping through the night, you're going to see someone whose testosterone has recovered. Later on in life, as you know, life becomes more challenging and our body begins to slow down, which happens at 30. The peak is really 25 to 30. Testosterone is not going to recover quite in the same way. And it's not just the level of testosterone. A man can actually make his own testosterone. What's really off is the relationship between the levels that are circulating and what the brain perceives. So that you may have the capacity to make testosterone, but if your testes are not getting that signal from the brain with other hormones, brain hormones called luteinizing hormone and follicle-stimulating hormone, your testes may just be quiet and your levels of testosterone that are circulating may be way too low. So there's a disconnect in the signaling, and that's what I really see happening. I have research that's been reported showing that men between the ages of even 30 and 80, the testosterone might be low, but it's the signaling mechanism that's really reduced, and they're not paying attention. Somehow their brain has lost sight of the fact that they have to keep a male's body at a nice level of testosterone in order for health to be sustained.
Does diet or does physical stature and fat levels within the tissue have anything to do with testosterone?
So diet, lifestyle, they have something to do, and they do impact testosterone, but largely if that's off. What really drives it is more likely your genetic makeup and what you inherit. And one of the areas that we see, one of the most important areas we see, is when we get calls from very young guys, I consider that 30, 35, in the 30s, generally if they're reporting clinical symptoms that are similar to low testosterone, we almost always find out that there's a first-degree relative, a father, a mother, grandparents, aunts, uncles, who's had cardiovascular disease. So there's a connection between cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and low testosterone at a younger age.
That sounds like what you're describing is what's called the metabolic syndrome, is the syndrome of mid-abdominal adiposity, fat around the midsection, perhaps high triglycerides, low HDL, pre-diabetic numbers, not necessarily full-blown diabetes. That is associated with low testosterone.
You're right. And so we do see that, and some men have full-blown metabolic syndrome, while others just express components of it. So another field that is related to this is your genes or your genomic profile. So if you come from a family, and I consider family history very important in terms of both diagnosis and management, I consider family history the poor man's genetic test. I'm sure you've heard of 23andMe
sure,
and the fact that they used to do genetic tests, and now there are companies coming along, and we work with one of them called Base Health that is enables us to look at the genetic makeup of individuals. But even if you can't or you don't choose to go that route, getting a good family history and finding out that there is metabolic syndrome or cardiac disease or diabetes or stroke usually means that the individual we're talking to, the man we're talking to, is at higher risk for low testosterone. But remember, we're just starting with low testosterone. We're also looking at other factors. We're looking at inflammatory molecules. We're looking at your carbohydrate metabolism. Are you a pre-diabetic? Virtually 80% of the patients we see come in with elevated sugars, mm-hmm. fasting sugars, and elevated hemoglobin A1Cs, which is a picture or a snapshot of the prior 3 months that actually take into account your lifestyle, your family history, your hormonal makeup. So it's a great way to get a handle on your future risk of diabetes. And that's really what's important here. What's really important is that you can find and pinpoint areas of risk for each unique person that allows them to maintain their health for the rest of their life. So even though testosterone has been a controversial topic, largely because of data that may or may not be great data, which we can talk about if you'd like, it's really about how do we maintain the body in the best, healthiest way we can for the rest of their life. How do we do that for an individual?
Well, you know, sometimes it is said that the hallmark of low testosterone is when men lose the morning erection. The morning erection is thought to be, you know, the sine qua non for low testosterone. But is it all about sex drive? Could it be that a man might have a sex drive intact, perhaps a little diminished, and he's figuring, well, you know, I'm 50 or I'm 60, and, you know, my sex drive is a little bit down, but it's, you know, I'm still having sexual relations with my partner. But other factors are more the telltale for the low testosterone.
There are many factors. It's really multifactorial. You can have a man who has a low testosterone and his perception of his ability to be sexually competent, get erections, maintain erections, and libido. All those are three different areas. And one good question to ask is what happens with the spontaneous morning erection? And yet he's perfectly fine and happy and content, as is his partner. A lot of times we do speak to the partners because sometimes you hear a different story.
Right.
And then you could see other men with a very high testosterone and they feel their performance is off. If you take the, let's say, average 40 or 50-year-old. And what's really fascinating there is it's so complex. It's multiple factors.
So there's plumbing factors. It's psychological factors.
You
know, there's a lot involved in not just, you know, if you have a full testosterone tank.
Exactly. There are people whose testosterone tank may be a quarter full, yet their drive is there, and there's a mind-body piece of it. There's an energetic piece of it. There's a sense of confidence, and I can perform this way, and I have no problem. Then there are other men where the testosterone might be high, and it's, I don't have any libido at all. But just, let's take two examples. We'll have a man who generally has a testosterone that's about 150 at, let's say, age 25. This is free testosterone, and let's mm-hmm. give him a total testosterone of 600 or 650. Mm-hmm.
Which is considered okay, or is average.
That would be average, right. Actually, low end of average.
A little low for a young man, it's
for a young
average.
Man, yep. It'd be a low end. It's the high end for the older man,
right.
The low end for the younger man.
Right.
Let's take another man who may have a total testosterone of 1,200 and free testosterone of 300. And both of those men come to me at the age of 50, and they both have equal testosterone levels. Each one has a free testosterone of 100 and a total testosterone of 250. Or, I'm sorry, their free testosterone, we'll use 100 just to make the example easy. Let's just say they have a free testosterone of 100.
Mm-hmm.
So take the man whose testosterone was 150. He's dropped about 50 points, or a third, right, of of from 150 to 100, he's lost 50 points. But that the other man who had a testosterone of 300, a free testosterone of 300, and is now at 100, has dropped far more significantly. And the receptors on his body, wherever they exist, from the brain to the heart to the penis, could be feeling that loss much more dramatically than the person who's adapted and had a level of 150 and is now dropped to 100.
I see. So it's kind of relative. It's relative. So in other words, if Bill Gates were to have an income next year of $500,000, $500,000, he'd feel horrible. He'd feel, oh my goodness, I'm poverty stricken.
Exactly.
But for the average person, we'd say, hey, you know, I'll take that. That sounds pretty decent to me.
Exactly. Well, the top 1% of the country probably.
Yeah, 1%ers, right.
You got it. That's exactly the way I think about it. And that's why it always drills down to the unique human being. And you not only have to look at levels, the metrics and the data are critically important. And that's what's really missing from a lot of the studies that get published and sort of sensationalized in the media. The data that's collected, the management and the follow-up is less than adequate. So prescriptions are handed out, but there's no follow-up. There's no initial baseline understanding. It looks like there's a great new treatment that can fix all your woes, and why not go that route mm-hmm. without understanding that the application of it has to do with the unique human being.
Well, this brings up
factors are important.
Yeah, this brings up an interesting issue because, you know, you're an expert endocrinologist, you know, you're well trained, you actually have specialized in this field, but frankly, there's a lot of chop shops out there where a man can go and get testosterone. It's like, I need some testosterone. They say, fine, here's some testosterone, and it's like one size fits all, and they administer therapy. And is that okay?
Not from my perspective, and I think that it's just a crapshoot, really. It's a one-size-fits-all, as you mentioned, and it's without any understanding of that unique human being and his function. And getting that information is what's really going to make a difference about your health. So testosterone's important. Let's face it, sexual function is really an important part of life. A lot of men who come in here are quite unhappy because they're loving in their marriage, and yet they can't satisfy their wife, and they really have questions about how to go about and perform, and they're nervous about what they should do about it. And in those cases, you're looking at it because you want them to perform and you want them to live life to the fullest. But if you can't take it to the next step where you're looking at their whole health and the way their life is going to turn out in terms of health, are they going to get a heart attack? Are they at risk for bone loss or osteoporosis, another very important, you know, bones are critically important in terms of the role testosterone plays, then you're overlooking all the other reasons that an investigation into what your testosterone levels will tell you is critical. It's not just about sexual function. Saying that, though, it is a clue. If a man at 35 or 40 or 45 notices a drop-off in his ability to get morning erections, it actually ties back to the fact that not only do they have to think about that, but it might be a precursor to heart disease. Because if you follow me for a minute here, yeah. Well, hopefully the audience will, your listeners will, the pudendal arteries that feed the penis are about a quarter of the size. If you think of a pipe, they're about a quarter of the size of the pipes in the coronary arteries that feed the heart. Those pipes get plugged up a lot quicker and a lot earlier in life than the heart. So there are a lot of studies and data in the scientific literature that show that you are at higher risk for heart disease if you experience erectile dysfunction to a degree that's just not fleeting, where from time to time you may have, you know, difficulty. But if it's pretty persistent and you're noticing that you're not like you used to, then it may be that your pipes, the pudendal arteries, are getting plugged up, because they are that much more narrow than your heart arteries or the coronary arteries.
So it may be true, as they sometimes say, that your morning erection is a dipstick for your heart disease status.
I love it. Yep, that's exactly what's said.
Although all the cars I bought lately can't even check the oil anymore. I asked, you know, my latest car, I said, where's the dipstick? And I said, sir, there is no dipstick. It's all electronic now.
Exactly. I remember having to learn to do that before my father would let me get a license. I had to learn how to take apart a car and put it back together, or at least check the engine, the oil, the tires, and change them myself. So not necessary anymore, thank God.
Well, and your father might be disappointed because, you know, that's not real automotive expertise.
He was, as it started right. happening, yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, this is a good inflection point because we kind of laid out the case for testosterone replacement and how we evaluate men for testosterone replacement. Let's stipulate this as part one of our discussion with Dr. Florence Comite. Her book is Keep It Up, The Power of Precision Medicine to Conquer Low T and Revitalize Your Life. And when we return, we're going to talk about how to undertake testosterone therapy. What are some of the options? Should it be smeared on? Should it be taken orally? Should it be injected? We'll talk a little bit about other types of restorative endocrine therapy, things like HCG and HGH. And we'll talk a little bit about the testosterone controversy, because all is not so rosy in testosterone land these days, because there are critics of testosterone therapy, and we'll address that as well in part two of our discussion with Dr. Florence Comite. Please join us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.